Different people have different religious observances when it comes to Yom HaShoah, which we're observing this week. Different people have different perspectives on it. So what I wanted to share tonight is, even separate from that discussion, just the idea of using it as an opportunity to reflect on some of the great giants who we lost during the war. There is a multi-volume work that it's very difficult to get a hand on now. You can find it in certain libraries, but it's hard to buy. Mirtz Hashem, one day I'll find it somewhere at a decent price. It's called, I'll tell you when it comes to me. Oh, someone's at the door in a second. So the name of the set of Sfarim is called Ela Ezkara, and
you,
it's...
You mentioned it before.
It's an amazing work.
You said if one of us wins the lottery.
Yes,
$400.
Oh, yeah.
So in there, they mention many, many great Rabbanim who were lost to us in the Shoah. And tonight I wanted to mention three as we think about Yom HaShoah and share a little bit of piece of Torah from each one. We're not going to mention the piece that's next because we mentioned him separately, of course. We'll just mention him because he's such an important figure. I want to kind of talk about a Lithuanian individual, a Hasidic individual, and then somebody who kind of melds the two. And a little shtickel Torah from each one. So it will be Makatzer. So the first person I want to introduce to you is Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. So some of you are familiar with Rabbi Elchanan. Rabbi Elchanan, and this biography I printed out from Encyclopedia Judaica. So he was born in 1875, and he studied in Volozhin and in Telz, and in 1903, he was appointed the head of his own yeshiva in Amshitlov, where he was a very big mashpia on his students. And then, in 1907, at this point, he was already a married man for 8 years with children, but he went to study with the Chofetz Chaim.
So he gave up his position?
Yes. And he became a cool younger man of the Chofetz Chaim. I heard this from Rabbi Palkovitz, Shalita, from the White Tree. He was talking about over Yantif. I'm good, thank you. He was talking about Rabbi Elchanan, and I never thought of it that way. I knew that he had gone to learn from the Chofetz Chaim, but he had given up his position as a Rebbe, as a Mechanich, to become, he was the head of a yeshiva, to become a kol younger man, just so that he had the opportunity to learn from the Chofetz Chaim. So that spoke to him, and that teaches us something about who he was. Then, after that, he became the rabbi of Brest-Litovsk, which is a famous Lithuanian community. Then, during World War I, he went back to the Chofetz Chaim. And after that, he went to Poland to establish his yeshiva in Baranovich. So, he was a very, very well-known Rosh Yeshiva in Baranovich. And then, at the outbreak of World War II, he fled to Vilna. At that time, the great Gaon, Reb Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, was the head of Lithuanian Jewry. He essentially marshaled all of the yeshivas to Vilna at the outbreak of the war. All the Polish, Lithuanian, Latvian, all these small yeshivas in the areas, Ukrainian, he told them all to come to Vilna, and he organized to take care of them. So Reb Elchanan went to Vilna at that time.
And then, because he thought it would be safer, or
I think so.
Financial?
I think so, and I think it was true because at that time, Vilna was under Russian occupation, as opposed to if you were on the other side, it was much worse.
Right.
So it happens to be that many of those students were killed, many of those Talmidim, many of those Bnei Yeshiva. Actually, it's funny, I have in the same file. Dr. Schneer Leinen came to Or Torah a couple of years ago when he spoke. This is actually a list he gave us, a published list. You'll see the names of the yeshivas from a sefer called Besofa Ubisa'ara, the names of the different yeshivas who arrived in Vilna. 2,336 bachrim from 23 different yeshivas.
Wow.
And these are the names: Radin, Kamenetz, Kletsk, Mir, Grodno, Mezrich, Baranovich. All the names and how many boys.
Huh.
I didn't think Mir ever ended up in Vilna.
Part of them, 273 Talmidim. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, then they went from there. I'm not sure if they went from there to Shanghai or others went to Shanghai. Most of the Mir Yeshiva was saved in Shanghai. But Rabbi Elchanan, he during his lifetime, he published this volume called the Kovetz Ha'aretz, which is comments on Maseches Yevamos, as well as an edition of the Tshuvas HaRashba. It has a Haskama here. You'll see the original Kovetz Ha'aretz with the Tshuvas HaRashba published in Pietrikov. Then his next one is published in Vilna. The original Haskama came from Rav Chaim Ozer, who was essentially, after the death of the Chavetz Chaim in the early 1930s, Rav Chaim Ozer was the leading rabbinical figure of the world, and his Haskama is for Rav Elchanan. So Rav Elchanan was a Gaon Adir, and he had so many Talmidim. After his death, many of his Talmidim published some of his Ha'aretz in volumes called Kovetz Shi'urim. In June of 1941, he was visiting Kovno, and he was arrested by the Nazis, and he was killed. I think it was called the 9th Fort or the 7th Fort, I forget the name of the location near Kovno, with many other thousands of Jews. And they describe in the introduction to the Kovetz Ha'aretz in this edition exactly the description of the final words that he had. This is the Yiddish description from those who were with him about how he spoke quietly as they were walking. I think it was called the 9th Fort. I'll tell you exactly. It was... they described that he was learning Maseches Nida, and they had to take him away while he was in the middle of learning. He spoke quietly, and he spoke about the fact that they were going to become karbonos, and that you have to be careful that he says, yeah, it's called the 9th Fort. That was where the Jews of Kovno were murdered. And he says, we have to be careful with how we think. Why? Because just like when it comes to an actual karbon, if you have an errant machshava, a machshava of pigel, it ruins the karbon. So too, if you have an errant machshava, when you're dying al kiddush Hashem, you don't want it to ruin your besirus nefesh. That's like unbelievable. That's what he's describing. And that's what they're and they have it here in the original Yiddish, and then they have the brackets here where they describe it in the back of this edition. So this was an unbelievable figure. So one little shtickle Torah that Rabbi Elchanan has that has become, at least when you learn Hilchos Shabbos, has become somewhat more well-known, actually appears in Ksubas, in the Talmidim's records, in the Kovetz Shiurim and Ksubas, in Os Yud Ches. He explains a well-known machlokas that actually some poskim have in terms of the concept of psik reisha when it comes to walking down the street and you accidentally, or you attempt, whatever it is, you flick on one of those...
Sensors.
So that sensor, when I'm walking down the street, so my intent is, if you ask me what I'm doing, I'm walking.
Right.
But if I happen to walk in a particular location where the sensor picks me up, so then I'm going to be violating, you know, potentially Havara. If it's a bulb, especially if it's an incandescent bulb, I'm going to be turning on that light. But when I walk down the street, I could care less whether the light goes on or not. Am I interested in that light going on? I'm not interested in that light going on at all. I don't care. The street has street lamps. I don't need it. That guy wants it for his own personal security system. It has nothing to do with me. So I'm not interested in it going on at all. So that's what we call in halacha, psik reisha de lo nichale. Psik reisha. So it's a question, lo nichale, lo ichbasle. It's a question halacha whether that's a distinction. Okay. Originally, in this classic Rishonim, it's referred to as lo nichalei, and then the discussion continues from there. It doesn't matter whether it's lo ichbaslei or lo nichalei, you don't want it. Happens to be when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, in this context, you probably don't want it at all. It's not yours, not your property, you don't benefit from it, you don't want the light to turn on.
So lo nichalei, that means it's to your detriment.
Exactly. So there is a discussion among different achronim whether or not there's a difference between that you're not interested in it or it's to your detriment. The simple understanding from the Gemara is that you're not interested in it. One example would be, I'm digging a hole in my friend's yard. It's Ba'ara de Chavra. It's not in my own yard. So I'm not interested. I don't really care. It's not to my detriment that I'm digging a hole in somebody else's yard. It's just, it has no consequence for me. So Bechana asked the following question. How do we understand this machlokes between Tosfos and the Aruch regarding Psik Reisha de Lo Nichalei? Right. What does the word psik reishi, the term psik reishi mean? Psik? Cut off the head of the chicken. Because in those days, what did your kids play with?
Chicken's head.
Apparently, right? It's a great, it's a great toy. Whatever. So you're going to say, I'm going to cut off the head of the chicken. Ah, it's going to die. I'm going to violate Natilas Neshama. It doesn't matter. I don't really care if it dies. It's not interesting. So that's a psik resha. Psik resha v'lo yamos. You're going to cut off its head. It's not going to die. Of course it's going to die. So Tosva says, yeah, even if it's a psik resha d'lo nichale, it's still a problem. It doesn't help you. There's a discussion. Maybe it's not a problem d'araisa. Maybe it's only a problem d'rabbanon. But it's still a problem. And the Aruch, which was an early Balatosvus who lived in Italy, he says, no, if it's a psik resha d'lo nichale, it's okay. So the question is, what is their argument about? Why is it that Tosvus thinks that it's a psik resha d'lo nichale, it's no good, it doesn't help you. Whereas the Aruch says it does. What's the argument?
Malachas Machsheves.
Okay, so what does it have to do with Malachas Machsheves? They have to water the Yisrael. So what's, how does it break down?
Secretion to Nichole, whether or not that's considered enough Machshava.
Okay.
Malach Machshava is Asher Torah. The Torah only answers Malacha that you thought to do, right?
Right, it's a creative Kavana.
Whether or not the category of Secretion is creates enough Machshava.
Oh. So that's one way of looking at it, that it's a function of the machshava. So then, how does that kind of play out in terms of the machlokas? Well, who holds what? So Rabbi Chanan takes your idea and develops it. He says, look, there are two ways that you can understand it. One way is maisa-oriented. It's focused on the activity. I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a nazir. A nazir has a question whether or not he's allowed to comb his hair, what kind of brush he's allowed to use.
Because it come out?
Exactly, because it may pull his hair out. Similarly, there's a question about this discussion regarding in the Gemara about dragging a bench outside in the ground when the earth is soft. Right? So you may make a ditch. So what about, so these are all examples. So let's take our dragging the bench example. Well, let's take the cutting of the chicken's head off, right? That's a classic segregation, right? I cut off the head of the chicken's head is going to die. So the first way to say it is, when you ask me what I'm doing, I tell you I'm getting a toy for my child. It happens to be that I'm also killing the chicken. So because it's a segregation, we say, what maisa did I do? I didn't do a maisa of procuring a toy. I did a maisa of... killing a chicken. That's what it is. That's the din of psik resha. It's that maisa is defined as a maisa of killing a chicken. Or you could say it differently. You could say, no, I didn't do that maisa. That's not really the issue. The issue is what Asher said. There's an element of kavana here. When you ask me what am I doing, I say, I'm getting a toy. And Halacha says, that's not true. Because you know you're killing the chicken. And it's as if you're having kavana to kill the chicken.
Is kavana user created or situation created?
Okay, so this is part of the question. So generally speaking, you have both elements. You have a general circumstance that is going to help give us the contours of your kavana, and then there's going to be your personal kavana. But in this case, if you have a psik resha denichale, I'm cutting off the head of the chicken. It happens to me now I have a shechted chicken. That's very good. So you can't say, it's I didn't have intent to do that. I was only, you know... let's say I'm a farmer. I have a farm with a field, and I need to plow the field, so I happen to be schlepping a bench. So you ask me, what am I doing? I say, I'm schlepping a bench. So we say, no, you're not. You are creating a furrow. You're plowing a field. So it's ki'ilu. You are miskaving for that.
But in those circumstances, you're aware that it's going to happen.
That's correct, because it's a psik resha. What about if it's a psik resha d'lo nichale, that you don't want it? So this, perhaps, says Rabbi Chanan, is exactly the debate between Tosfos on the one hand and the Aruch on the other hand. Tosfos says psik resha is about a maisa, about an action. And therefore what?
Intent doesn't matter.
Bingo. When you're pulling the bench, since it's a psik resha, we say that's a maisa of charisha. That's digging. A maisa of charisha, done and done. You're round. But if you say, no, that's not the point of psik resha. It's not that psik resha says, you did a maisa of Melech HaShabbos. Psik resha says, you thought you weren't having kavana to plow? We'd say, yes, you are. Whether you like it or not, If it's psik reishis then lichale, we are redefining your kavana. Your kavana is to make a furrow. You went out to drag a bench, that's fine, but the halacha says you really went out and you also had kavana to plow. Memela, now this is your svara, but if it's lo nichale, you can't tell me that my kavana, which is for over here, is going to be attributed to a kavana over there. If it's clearly lo nichale, you're not going to connect the dots. And therefore the Arach says, psik reishis, the lo nichale, is not usur. Because psik reishis is only a problem when it makes you have kavana. But if your kavana is to say, no way, I don't want it, then it's not going to be a problem. Make sense?
So, the way he wrote Rav Chaim said,
yeah,
explaining the machlokes between the
Tosfos and the Arach, yeah.
The Tosfos is saying,
it's
a matter of the action that you're doing.
Exactly.
And the Arach is saying it's a matter of your thought. So
meaning, exactly, and that is the question of how to define what psik reishis does. Generally speaking,
I mean, could you theoretically say that they're both discussing that it's a matter of your thought, or just when do you have enough thought to really constitute the malacha?
It could be, but the question is, that's not how Rav Chaim is explaining it. I'll tell you why, because then it's somewhat arbitrary as to why it is that Tosfos says the line is here and the Arach says the line is there.
Right.
What's the compelling rationale for Tosfos?
I mean, if just going back to what I had said, sure. And I don't know if this is where the whole concept of psik reishis comes from, but if it comes from the idea that you need that malacha machshava and asur Torah, then to just make a distinction between maise and machshava doesn't make complete sense.
So I'll tell you the answer.
But to say, to make a distinction between two levels of machshava, and then that being the litmus test of whether nichle or lo nichle is just the litmus test of the level of your machshava.
Could be. I'm not saying it's not true. It's very possible. It is a question of as to whether or not davar she'eino miskaven, which is the broader category for psik reishis, something that's an unintended consequence, is unique to Shabbos, or it's general din kol Torah kula. It happens to be that it's not so simple to answer that question. For sure, there's definitely an added element on Shabbos, which means that even Rabbi Yehuda, who says that you don't require psik reishis, you're not allowed to do a davar she'eino miskaven in general, he will say that on Shabbos, that's not an issur d'oraisa in the same way that it would be during, you know, chol, because it's not malachas machshavas. But you're right. So in Achanami, it could be
not only in Shabbos.
So, exactly. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses psik reishis. Actually, it's a context of dental care for parents. It's a halachic question about dental care for parents. This comes up inshallah halacha lemaisa. Medical school, medical care for parents.
Mm-hmm.
Can a doctor provide medical care for his parents? Because there's an isser of haka,
yeah,
a chavala of kibra ve'im, and a maka of ve'imo.
Right.
Maka ve'imo, that's an isser skila. That's serious business. So what about dental care? So then the question becomes, well, it's a davar she'eino miskaven. I'm not intending to wound the parent. I'm intending to help them. It happens to be this.
Or if you're doing aspirating
surgery. It's an interesting question. So these
it's
are
not unique to dentistry, though.
No, I bring it up because it happens to be a dentist who raised that question. But in Achanami, it's true. For the Gemara has it in terms of removing a splinter. Can a child take a splinter out of a parent?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he takes it out, then he pulls the skin and he causes them to bleed. So that's Chovel, but it's davar she'eino miskaven because you can theoretically get it out without causing the parent to bleed. So it's an interesting discussion. So that's where it's
even injection. Sometimes you want to draw back the blood,
right? So that's a question of what kind of injection is it? Subcutaneous? Is it?
But in dentistry, in particular, and I think this is where I've seen this question come up. When you give an injection, you aspirate. Like when you give an injection, yeah, you pull back on the syringe to make sure certain drugs you don't want to put into a vein.
Right.
So you pull back on the syringe to potentially draw blood. And you're not looking for the blood. You don't want to have a negative aspect.
So that would be a davar she'eino miskaven without a psik reishis. It's an unintended consequence without guarantee you're going to be hitting it. So this comes up in terms of, it's an interesting thing to think about. Sometimes when certain posts can discuss these issues about the automatic sensors, because the automatic sensors, that's a psik reishis. A davar she'eino miskaven with a psik reishis, de lo nichale. Well, depending on whether or not you view it as an issue of kavana or an issue of chad maisa, whether it's the Tosfos or the Arach, that may play into this, because maybe you could say, well, how could you say it's chad maisa if I'm over here and the light is over there? Maybe if you're trying to say that Psik Resha is about being one action, who says you can say one action if something is over here and not over there? So the idea of trying to understand the logic of Psik Resha is going to be really important when you're going to play it out in practical cases of innovations that are now invoking new dinim of Psik Resha.
You know what the sensor is, right?
Right, but...
So like if you're right in front of it, any sensor is going to go off. So, except for the one in my backyard.
But so it depends. It depends... Darshina Miskavi means an unintended consequence that's not guaranteed to happen. Psik Resha means it's guaranteed to happen. So depending on your proximity, that'll determine whether it's a general Darshina Miskavi, which is Machlokas Reb Shimon Reb Yehuda, or it's Psik Resha, where Reb Shimon is Moda, and then it's Psik Resha Nichale or No Nichale. So that's just one little snippet of Torah from Reb Elchanan. Let's move to the world of Chassidus, although this is distinctly a very unusual work, and that is the work entitled Eim Habanim Smecha from Reb Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. Reb Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal was a Hungarian Rav. He was born, I'll tell you, in 1885, and he was a dayan in Busarmin and afterwards in Fishtian, which is a Slovakian community. And he was the Rosh Hashiva of a yeshiva called Moria, which was a yeshiva for being machshir rabbonim and poskim. This is a picture of Rav Teichtal. And he grew up undoubtedly in the Hungarian Hasidic milieu, you know, maybe one of the most dominant, well-known figures in this context is the Munkacsér Hasidim. And the Munkacsér Hasidim are decidedly and unabashedly anti-Zionist. And that's a sentiment that pervades Hungarian...
He's a Munkacsér or a Satmar?
Well, I don't know if he's any of the above, but he's certainly in that...
What color are the socks?
I don't know. So he's in the, I don't know if he, which specific
I just thought he was sat
I'm not sure if he was specifically one or the other, but he certainly grew up in that context. He published in Budapest, he published a series of tshuvas in 1943 called Mishnas Sachir. I assume it's called Sachir because his name was Yisachar. But he was a well-known posek, not just a Rosh Hashiva, a posek, a major figure in Hungarian Jewry. And he describes in the work that he has here called Eim Habanim Smecha, is that after the onset of the war, which the first couple of years he survived, because Hungarian Jews, by and large,
was somewhat
insulated until 1944, mm-hmm. He has a dramatic, and I can't say it's sui generis because I can't speak for all of Torah literature on this topic, but it is incredibly unique. And that is, not only does he see a complete, have a complete change of heart, he begins to essentially crusade the concept of practical Zionism among anybody who would listen to him. And he creates one of the very few rabbinic works that was published during the war, and that is this work called Eim Habanim Smecha, which was published while he was in Budapest.
You know what was responsible for his change of heart?
He tells you. It was the destruction of European Jewry. Because by 1942... he and other Hungarian Jews, they maybe didn't know exactly what was happening in the death camps, but they knew enough to know that European Jews were being destroyed by the Germans. And he felt, he understood that it had been a catastrophic error in dissuading people from going to at that time was called Palestine, from going to Eretz Yisrael to settle. Who knows how many Jews they would have been able to save.
A political error, like a religious error? I mean, he's taking this, does he incorporate Hasidic thought into it?
So that is perfect. So that is exactly what is right here in my hand. And this is the Shar Blot of the original publication, Budapest Tufshin Gimel, Eim Habonim Smecha. What is it? Meyusad al... Geulaseinu v'al pedus nafshinu migolos ha'achron hazeh asher nasa kol ma shabori kol ha'olam ha'zalokinu v'lokei avosinu mevakish me'itonu mitzavos son olios lasos be'inyan kirvas ha'geula. And what's that? And that is based on all the ma'amarim that he's going to quote to build the land to come to Eretz Yisrael. So it's a manifesto, a religious manifesto about the significance, religious significance, not political significance, religious significance. And that is this thick volume, which is just tons and tons, incredible bekiyas, incredible, incredible bekiyas about the importance of coming to Eretz Yisrael. And this book has now become a classic in the religious Zionist community. And what's so ironic is that it's written by a Hungarian Hasidic Rav, who, because of his experiences in the Holocaust, it gave him pause to rethink his own personal religious worldview. So this book is...
What's the Hasidic movement think of this?
So, not everybody...
I mean,
he was crazy.
Modern Zionist, like, just because it's written by a Hasid, like, it's like a...
It's not so posh how it was received in the Hasidic communities, but the idea that you have this incredible bekiya. So what you have here is something that's doubly fascinating and incredibly inspiring. One is a sefer that, aside from the Ish Kodesh, I don't know how many other svarim that were published during the war at that time. I don't know. Number two is this whole unique transformation. So why does he call the sefer Eim Abanim Smecha? That's what I wanted to share with you. So he says, I'll tell you why. Based on the Yerushalmi and Brachos, he says, and this is the end of the Hakadamah Shnia, he says, I'll tell you why, because it's the Yerushalmi in the end of the in the end of Sof Perek Hayakore, in the end of the second Perek in Brachos, it refers to Eretz Yisrael as Eim, the mother of Yisrael, and the other nations, the other lands, as like the Eim Choreges, like the foreign adoptive, you know, surrogate or foster parents. And he quotes from a Maimar Chazal, from a Psikta, that our mother Tzion is crying and waiting for us to come home. That's why he calls it Eim Habanim Smecha, the happy mother, meaning on the return of her children. But now he tells you a story. He says, I will tell you, God will tell you that I understand exactly why this is called Eim Habanim Smecha. Because he says, I saw the story with my own eyes. He says, it was in 1942, right before Pesach. The Gezerah went out in Slovakia by the wicked, the wicked cursed ones, to take all girls, single girls, from the age of 16, and to round them up. And he says, we don't know where they're going, and who knows what's going to happen to them. So there was a tremendous Bahala. And one guy, he says, tried to save his daughters, he had two daughters, to save them and cross the border to escape with his girls. The mother was at home, the father took the two daughters to try to escape by foot over the border. He says it was Chol Hamoed Pesach, and he promised his wife that he would send her a telegraph from over the border that they received it there. And so the woman is sitting and waiting and waiting for the telegraph and waiting. And what was the Maisa Shehaya? Before they got over the border, they were caught. And they were taken to a jail near the border. And they sat there all of Chol Hamoed and the last days of Sukkot. And they were concerned. There was a terrible fear that they would be sent to the east. And he says, in addition to the fact that, of course, it was against the law to try to run away, so they were very concerned. He was, in the meanwhile, the wife finds out that they had been caught and that they were incarcerated. And he says, V'nucha l'shar meha-hergesh meha-regesh hamar she-tofasosa. He says, you can only imagine the anguish of this poor woman, how her beautiful yontif was smashed and destroyed by this notion that her husband and her two daughters their life is hanging in the balance. What happens? He quotes the Gon, the Tzaddik, this person, who was it? Rav Shmuel David Ungar, who was the Nitra Rav, there's a community today, a Hasidic community in Westchester, in Mount Kisco, called Nitra, the Nitra Hasidim. They were Slovakian. So the Rav Dov, Shmuel David Ungvar was the Rosh Hashiva of Nitra, and he was up day and night taking care, trying to save as many Hungarian Slovakian Jews during the war. He had an accomplice, a helper, whose name was Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel. Anybody hear of him? He wrote a book called Min HaMeitzar that I have at home. I could have brought it. And he describes negotiating with Germans, trying to save Jews. He has diagrams of the initial concentration camp drawings from Jews who escaped and came to tell them in Slovakia. And it's published in Art School, a version of it called The Unheeded Cry. It's amazing. So these two Nitra Chassidim, the Rosh Hashiva and Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel, they were busy trying to save people. So he describes that the Gaon and the Tzaddik, the Rosh Hashiva of Nitra, of Shmuel Dovan Ungvar, redeemed the father and the two daughters were for a huge sum of money. And they came down, they came home on the Yom Tov HaAcharon Shal Pesach, Vahudiuzos Tekev Vahudah Telephonis Lehaisha. They came to inform her by telephone on the last day of Pesach that her husband and her two daughters were going to be returned to her. He says, on the next day of Pesach, they were going to come back. Ein tzorach lesaper. He says, you cannot, obviously, you don't even need to describe what this means to this woman, this terrible, downtrodden woman. And when the second that they walked in the door, how her all of her life just gushed forth in emotion. No one ever saw joy, the kind of joy that this mother saw to see her husband, her two daughters, come back alive to their home. So he says, that's what I imagined. That's when I imagined, Kein ani medame umetar lefana me'asimcha shel imenu Eretz Yisrael. That's what I imagined, the simcha of our mother, of the Jewish nation, that is the land of Israel, when we all come back. Amazing. And he says, that's why I call this Sefer Ema Banam Smecha. So, unfortunately, he was sent to Auschwitz, and in 1945, he survived the war, but when they were evacuating Auschwitz, he died. But this is unbelievable. So that's Rav Yisachar Teichtal. Okay, the last figure I want to mention, that's the Ema Banam Smecha. The last figure I want to mention is somebody who, if you have a smartphone, maybe you can do a quick Google search, because I didn't bring the file with me. And it's available now also in English in an expanded version, and now they're working on a condensed version. His name was Rav Menachem Zemba. If you get a picture of him online, it's mamish like you're inspired just looking at him. Rav Menachem Zemba, Ziemba. Zemba.
Have you mentioned him before?
I probably have, because he's amazing.
Weird. Picture of Charlie Chaplin comes up for some reason. Is this which one?
Yes, top middle. Yes, that's Rav Menachem Zemba.
So Rav Menachem. That.
Okay, thank you to them. So that's a picture. Take a look. That's a picture of Rav Menachem Zemba.
You showed us that picture before.
It could be. I have it at home. I couldn't find it today when I was searching for it in the files. So Menachem Zemba is a unique person because on the one hand, he includes in his personality, in his Torah personality, both classic, standard yeshiva lumdus, but also he was orphaned at a young age and he was raised, if I'm not mistaken, he was raised by the Sfas Emes himself, the Ger of Hasidim, specifically by the Sfas Emes, the Ger Rebbe. That was basically his foster father. So he combines kind of this incredible force of Limud and the warmth and the vitality and the Lebedekite of Hasidus. Now, initially, he worked for a living. He didn't want to become a rabbi. It was only after his parnasa didn't work out that as a young man, he became a rabbi in Poland. I think he was one of the Dayanim in Warsaw. And he was a tremendous gaon. And he wrote many incredible svarim. And he is one of the very well-known figures from the Warsaw Ghetto. He would go, according to Hillel Seidman, Dr. Hillel Seidman was one of the chroniclers afterwards. He wrote a book called The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries. He was one of the survivors of the ghetto. He wrote a chronicle of what happened during the ghetto, and he describes some of the personalities that he met there. One of the people he describes in the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, Hillel Seidman does, is Rav Menachem Zemba. Rav Schwartz Shlita told me that he remembers meeting Hillel Seidman, who spoke to him. So he describes how Rav Menachem Zemba would go, is one of the Rabbanim who was arranged in going from sewer to sewer for a network of Bachrim who are learning in clandestine yeshivas in the ghetto. They had bunkers and sewers, and he would go around giving chizuk and giving bachinas to the boys who were learning. Rav Menachem Zemba had to move apartments because he was always on the run being chased. At one point, he was in the top floor of an apartment building on Sukkos. So he was able to break through the roof to make a little sukkah with schach, and people lined up to come to his apartment to stand in to make the bracha on Leishiva Sukkah, Rav Menachem Zemba's sukkah. And what's the most famous story of Rav Menachem Zemba, I believe? It's that at a gathering on Hanukkah in a cellar somewhere, Rav Menachem Zemba gave a drasha sanctioning and supporting armed resistance in the ghetto. You know, there's some, you know, question about whether or not religious Jews supported armed resistance. Different, there were different approaches. Rav Menachem Zemba gave a drasha on Hanukkah, and what did he invoke on Hanukkah?
I think we talked about the
Maccabees. Exactly. He invoked the Chashmonaim and the Maccabees in that the same way that they had Bayom Imayim, Bazman Hazeh. So he spoke out in favor of the Nazi, fighting against the Nazis up front, which is what in a few months' time became the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So he was one of the famous rabbinic leaders who was at the forefront of supporting the ghetto uprising. And what Hillel Seidman describes, which is a tragic thing, which was that he himself had an opportunity to get out. People had offered him papers, but he was concerned to leave. Hillel Seidman said because he had written a multi-volume work, a humongous manuscript. I believe one was on the Rambam, another one was on the Yerushalmi. Hundreds and hundreds of pages. Life work. And he didn't know if he could get it out, not get it out. By the time he was able to sort everything out, he was murdered. He was shot dead, moving from one house to the next. This is one sefer that survived.
Is it the only one?
There's another sefer that's of tshuvas, but it's not really his tshuvas. Some of them are his letters, but some of them are others. It's kind of like a combination. This is the sefer that has survived. It's on the Maleches Shabbos of Hotzah. It's on Hotzah. And in the Hakdama, they give you a little bit of his life story. And it was Chol HaMoed Pesach, Yud Tes Nisan, 1943, which was during the time of the uprising. He was running from a burning building, and he was gunned down on Shabbos, Chol HaMoed Pesach. And at night, when they were able to go out, they brought him to the Kavura. And only later on, they in Tavshin Yud Ches, they brought him from Poland to Eretz Yisrael to rebury him, to reinter him. So he has tremendous shtickel Torahs here from Praga. Praga is not Prague. Praga is like a small suburb of Warsaw. That's what you see. Kuntres Binyane Midine Shabbos Menachem Zemba Mi Praga. So just one little Dvar Torah is where he has a beautiful distinction between Ovos and Toldos of Shabbos. And it's a much longer discussion. We don't have so much time now. But he says, wait a second. What's the difference between an av and a toldo? The Gemara says in the beginning of Baba Kama, there's no difference. The Gemara says in Shabbos, there's no difference. But there is a Ran. The Ran points out that when you have what's called a malacha, she'ein tzricha legufo, that's only when it comes to avos. It doesn't come to toldos. We don't have time to talk about all these different things. Avos and toldos, avos, ein tzricha legufo. But Rav Menachem Zemba does something ingenious. He says, think about it. Every malacha breaks down to two components. Like you said before, Asher, meleches, machsheves. Meleches is the activity, machsheves is the intent, right? So he says, wait a second, an av malacha has a pu'ula, the structure, and then there's the kavana, the intent, the machsheva. So an av malacha has the original action and the original intent. So let me give you an example. The malacha of dash, threshing, extracting. So the original pu'ula was taking a kernel, that has chaff and smashing on it and smashing it off, smashing out the breaking off the chibur so that the kernel comes out from the chaff. So that's the action, the banging to extract. The intent is to remove one thing from the other. So a tolda of dash would be schita. If I take a grape and I squeeze it, so the action is not the same because I'm not banging, but I'm squeezing, but the purpose is the same, to extract one substance from the other. Well, what about if you have the reverse? You can have something where the action is the same, but the purpose is different. So that's what we would call in halacha a malacha, where I'm doing the action, but ein sricha legufa, I'm doing it for a different reason. For example, let's say the window was open here, or the blinds were up, and I wanted to look outside, and there's a branch standing in the way. So you know what I do? I snap off the branch. That's a malacha. It's an action called kotzer, harvesting wood, cutting off a branch. So the action looks the same as the avalacha of kotzer, but the intent is not for harvesting, it's for just looking out the window. Exactly. So Menachem Zendis says an awesome shot in the Ron. You ready? He says, what's an av? An av is when you have both. A tolda, he says, is like the grape squeezing, right? A tschita is a tolda of dash, where you're lacking the intent, but the action looks the same. What happens if you do a tolda without the intent? Then you have neither. Why does the Ran say, the Chiddush of the Ran is that a tolda does not have Ein Tzricha L'Gufa? Why? Just because it's a tolda, what's the difference if I did Dash or I did Schita Ein Tzricha L'Gufa? What's the difference?
Nothing, right.
What's the Av again?
The Av has both the action and the intent. The tolda has the same intent, the same purpose, the tachlis, but not the same action. So therefore, Menachem Zenda says, well, therefore, if you did a tolda, which the only similarity is what?
The intent.
The intent. But if you did it for a different purpose, then...
You don't need intent.
Bingo. Says Menachem Zenda, that's the pshat in the Ran. That's why there's no problem in this Ran to do a tolda ein tzricha l'gufa.
What's an example of that?
So let's say you're squeezing out a grape, not because you want the juice, but because you want the grape to be dry. Okay. That would be the example. Let's say you have a cloth, and the cloth is wet. So that's exactly part of the discussion. In the Ran is discussing, you have a wet cloth, and you're sticking it into a barrel to be a spigot, and some of the wine drips down. So it gets into this whole complicated story, but Rav Menachem Zenda, the genius and the clarity of just like, it was such a simple distinction that he puts out there, and it just makes so much sense. And this is kind of the type of incredible, obviously they have both Rav Chanan and Rav Yisachar Teichtal and Rav Menachem Zenda, they have tremendous bekiyas, but they also have beautiful analysis, each in their own way. And this is something that we think about in Yom HaShoah. We talk about these great figures and all the Torah that Baruch Hashem that we have, but imagine all the mountains and mountains of Torah that we lost, and we have to try to learn as much as we can to kind of fill that void in some infinitesimal way in our own generation. Yeah.